Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michaela Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27.
Today, I wanted to bring you another voice of a British citizen living in the EU in a time of Brexit. And I'm joined over the phone by Ian in Sweden. Ian works in the university sector. And you've been living in Sweden for how long, Ian?
I guess 15 years now, which of course is a magical barrier in the land of British citizens abroad.
Absolutely. So how did you, tell us how you came to be living in Sweden.
I suppose in some ways it's a funny story. I've been to Denmark quite a few times. My parents were living in Copenhagen in the 90s. And then I went to a conference in Vienna and met a Swedish person. We had the beginnings of a relationship, but we didn't think of moving to Sweden. I was living in the UK at the time and had a pretty nice job in the UK university sector. So we had our first child and tried to live in a British town, rather unsuccessfully given the miserable academic salary. There just came a moment when we realised, when our second child was on his way, that we probably couldn't make it work in the UK without some sort of financial help. So we decided to move to Sweden. So we upped and moved in, 15 years ago, 2004. I found some small pieces of work and then eventually got myself a full-time job and have lived here happily ever since.
So you moved with no job?
I had a permanent job in the UK, and I basically said, I need to get out. The work life was too hard, and we had a small family, and so I thought, right, I'll become a, what they call in Swedish, a free-time dad, and then picked up bits of work in Sweden and then eventually in Denmark, and then sort of worked my way back up the ladder, so to speak.
What was it that you thought would make living in Sweden easier than living in the UK?
There were two factors. One was to do with children and education. About half of my salary was going to pay for our daughter at the time, my spare salary, she would put this, to be in daycare while I was working. And then, of course, with number two on the way, that meant I'd have nothing left. And then once I worked out that, in fact, in Sweden, it didn't really cost anything. That was a factor. We already had family in Sweden, which made things easier. My British family is dispersed all over the place. But also, we couldn't really afford a home that we wanted in the UK. And housing prices are relatively lower, although everything else is relatively higher in Sweden. So there was a mixture of kind of social family context and then quite cold, hard economic rationale, I suppose.
What was it like settling in Sweden? It sounds like you'd already travelled around quite a bit before you moved to Sweden, but was there any things that really stood out to you about that settlement, I suppose?
Sweden is two countries. It's the country you see and you think you know, but in fact don't. And then, I guess like all societies, it's the Sweden under the surface. So it's like an incredibly hard nut to crack, but it's incredibly soft inside, if I can use that kind of metaphor. So it's very difficult meeting Swedes and getting to know Swedes and being accepted into their culture, their society. They tend to keep the friends they sort of grew up with and went to school with, and they don't really travel that far in terms of moving and stuff. So that was quite hard. Plus, learning Swedish itself is quite easy, but really hard to speak because everybody in Sweden speaks much better English than you speak Swedish. So it took a very long time to sort of crack the nut and break into the language, but also break into Swedish society and being accepted as kind of one of them in some respects.
Yeah, so I suppose after 15 years, how do you feel? Do you feel like you've been accepted now?
Well, I do, but also I don't, because in 2009, I took a pretty good job in Copenhagen, where I started commuting across the Öresund crossing on a daily basis. So for the last 11 years, I've been what I describe as a transborder commuter. So that makes things a lot more complicated, not just the fact that Danish is really difficult, I think, for a non-native Swedish speaker to understand, but your work environment and your home environment are not just different countries, they're different languages, and there's very different contexts to the conversation. So that's made things, I suppose, more challenging than most other people that sort of move to another country and then try and naturalise.
Yeah, I had the privilege of going on that train earlier on this summer. And it is remarkable, really, that how, because what you're talking about is a very small distance geographically, but quite a big distance in other terms, I think. And I wondered, that bridge is very central to your story about living in Europe. You talk about, in your written contributions to the project, you've talked about how your father was involved with building that bridge. So it's obviously got some kind of family history to it, but it's also become part of your daily life. What do you think that Brexit means in the context of this kind of cross-border movement that you're involved in on this daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, my experience of Brexit that's been and the Brexit to come is different in this respect. I think people assume that membership of the EU gives you a sort of bilateral rights, you know, the right to travel, the right to move, the right to set up a company or to buy things or to sell things. But if you are a transborder commuter, and I'm not alone, there's about 20,000 Danes and Swedes and others commute every day across the Öresund, you start to realise that it's not bilateral, it's tri or multilateral. I have the right to work in Denmark, not because I'm Swedish or British, but because I'm an EU citizen. If I was not an EU citizen, I couldn't live in Sweden and get a job in Denmark, because you'd need to be resident in Denmark to do that. So you start to realise that membership of the EU is about freedoms that travel with you, not just the right on a bilateral relationship. For instance, my dad, it was a civil engineer, and he built and designed quite a few bridges, the first and second Severn crossings between England and Wales he was involved in. So he was involved in the design and the build of the Öresund crossing. So they lived in Copenhagen, but actually he was working with the tunnel construction on the Swedish side. So it sort of has a double meaning for us in that it facilitates my life, entirely coincidentally, interestingly, and it was one of the last projects he did. But the story is the same. The bridge was built by a lot of engineering groups across Europe, Danish and Swedish led, certainly, but it was Dutch tunnel builders and designers from the UK and other countries that were responsible. Most big projects are EU multilateral like this and involve many different partners because they have to be. You don't have the expertise yourself. So my experience, I suppose, is quite different. The distance is only about 20 kilometres between Sweden and Denmark. And it takes 10 minutes on the train to get from Hillier to Kastrup Airport. My whole commute is about an hour, I suppose, from point to point.
When you wrote to me, you did say that, I think that you have Swedish citizenship anyway, so at least from your point of view, there won't be an immediate disruption to your ability to work cross-border. But you are concerned about what Brexit means for cross-border workers, aren't you?
Yeah, very much so. Because it's a very much a hidden mobility, people haven't thought long and hard about this. And I've spoken to, for instance, the British ambassador in Denmark about this, and he doesn't really get it because, of course, he's a bilateral, you know. And I think cross-border commuters are tri or multilateral. There are a couple of different aspects to this. I mean, firstly, I took Swedish citizenship because I saw what was coming, and it hasn't happened yet, but it will come. On the Swedish side, the rise of the far-right Swedish Democrats will make it increasingly difficult, as it is in Denmark, to get and naturalise in the country, even if you've lived there a very, very long time. So, for example, I couldn't take Danish citizenship because I don't fill in enough points in their point system. And people haven't thought about this. It's not as easy to naturalise as people think.
And, of course, Denmark is one of the most punitive migration regimes in the EU, isn't it?
Yeah. It's absolutely one of the worst, and it's getting worse and worse. So friends of mine who are not Danes but lived all their life and their children are Danish still cannot get Danish citizenship. And there's some debate in Sweden over which degree to copy this model to prevent people naturalising, even though they already live there and have done, let's say, for decades. The second component is that it was quite clear when I encountered what the British government wanted to do in its renegotiation with the EU, it was quite clear to me that nobody in the British government had any idea whatsoever of what they were doing, and that's still the case. And I think what's likely is that there's a risk of a spiralling descent of reciprocal collapse of rights and recognition for citizens and companies, even with bilateral trade agreements in place, if those are ever achieved in my lifetime, which I somehow doubt. It's very difficult as a cross-border commuter already. And let me give you some sort of passing example from people I know. Employers in that cross-border relationship know that you're in trouble if you try and change job. If you don't have and haven't naturalised in the other country, let's say the second country as opposed to the third where you work, they know it'll become increasingly difficult for you to change job or to find a new job in that country. And they've got you because it will become increasingly more difficult to get promotion, to change job, to negotiate salary improvements, for instance. So you're then forced to think about returning to the second country for a job. And that's quite a desperate situation. Now, there are other cross-border commuters, but there are a lot of people that hold down jobs in more than one country because of the nature of their work, whether they're educators, engineers, or financial legal experts. These sorts of challenges will become worse, even if you negotiate bilateral agreements on citizenship rights. They simply won't travel with you, whether it's the financial services industry, the educational industry, and Europe has become an educational industry because of the Bologna process. These rights won't travel and they're unlikely ever to travel. So there's this hidden, let's say, trap that people really haven't started thinking about too hard, about shifting from EU citizenship to a sort of bilateral agreements, a series of bilateral agreements on citizenship.
What you're describing is a situation where the bilateral agreement would mean that you could carry on doing what you're doing, but it would make it very difficult if you lost your job or if you wanted to look for another job. So you, if we're talking about you, you'd struggle to get a new job in Denmark, and you might equally struggle to get a job in Sweden for lots of reasons.
Yeah. But it's not just that, it's the rights that come with you. So in Sweden, for instance, as a father, you have the right to quite comprehensive parental leave. But if you take that, it's up to your Danish employer to recognise them, because that's not a right you hold in the country. So you're in a very difficult kind of grey area all the time of, for instance, if I'm sick, who certifies my sick leave? Is it a Swedish doctor or a Danish doctor because I'm employed in Denmark? All these sorts of very complicating factors, from employment rights, union rights, health rights, social protection, none of that stuff is going to travel if you're working in a third country. It's a trap because it becomes increasingly difficult to gain and exercise those rights.
And at the moment, how you are positioned is precisely as a result of working in a highly integrated labour market in Europe, because higher education is highly integrated as a sector.
That's correct.
That is then underpinned by all of those social protections, all of those rights and entitlements that you have access to because you are an EU citizen, not because you are a citizen of an individual member state.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Now, I've heard arguments that, well, I'm unique. But I think you're going to be in for a surprise. Everyone's going to be in for a surprise. Maybe I'm one of the very few that cross-border commutes, but, you know, many people live and work across a great many European borders because they're not there, whether it's in Luxembourg, Germany, France, Denmark, Belgium, the Netherlands. These are borders that are utterly permeable, and not just commuting to and from work. People that work in several different places or employed by, let's say, British employers to work in several different places. These kind of cross-border rights that we tend to take for granted about sick leave, about union protection, about childcare rights and taking time off if your child is sick, they evaporate the moment you move from an EU citizenship right to a kind of a bilateral trade agreement right.
Yeah, I can tell you that you're not unique even within the research. I've come across other people who are in similar situations, and I think of people at different stages in their academic life course as well. In their case of higher education, the postdocs who've been crossing borders following labs and things like that, who may at this point in time find themselves coming to the end of a contract, which then, you know, does make things challenging in terms of whether they will be able to pursue the next opportunity in the next laboratory somewhere else. So,
well, if I can just interject and speak for my students, we have a large number of British students that I teach and have taught both in Sweden and Denmark. And one of the reasons we have a large number is because they can be educated in English. Exchange students, whether Erasmus or not, tend to go to countries where they can fit in and get good grades. And so the country that teaches in English has the better route for them to study. And many, perhaps most, develop relationships, have boyfriend, girlfriends, etc., put roots down. They hope to stay in the country where they're changing. Now, right now, we still have British students because Danish authorities have allowed some degree of leeway with students to continue studying. But all of these students know with very dark faces that their future possibilities are shrinking really rapidly for this type of experience and exchange. And to be honest, without that, it's very difficult for people that want to work in or participate in what I would describe as kind of, as you say, highly skilled working areas, whether that's education, medicine, engineering, finance. These areas are areas where you need experience, cross-cultural experience, perhaps another language. And without them, you're a lesser country if you lose these employment areas. To be a British citizen living in Sweden and working in Denmark is a sort of an exercise in humility in some respects. Because on one hand, you can see the things that work and don't work in other people's countries. On the other, you can look back at Britain and go, oh, if only they had the Swedish citizenship process or, you know, electronic social security numbers or something like that. And so after a while, you neither Swedish nor Danish nor British. You're somewhere in between. And that becomes part of your identity, for good or for bad. I mean, sometimes it's painful having to admit that, there's this thing called the House of Lords where people are appointed and they get to rule on British politics. But on the other hand, we're pretty good at queuing. But there's another side to this, and it's sort of even more painful. One of the things that I trade on, so to speak, one of the things that is my professional identity is the fact that I know rather a lot about the UK and its relationship to the EU. So, you know, when the Danish Parliament or Danish media want me to speak about Britain, that's something I can do. That is me. That's what I do. I'm a British Britain in the EU expert. Or if they want me to compare Sweden and Denmark and Britain on immigration or trade policy or on defence policy or on the euro, I can do that. That's me. I am that sort of British guy in Denmark that can do that. But when Britain leaves the EU, I'm no longer that guy. Nobody wants to hear about what Canada or the US or the UK or New Zealand know about the EU, because they'll be peripheral to many of the most important forces, social, political and economic, across Europe. So it's doubly painful in that respect. And yeah, that is part of my identity. It's who I've been and who I continue to be over the last 15 to 25 years, I suppose.
I mean, how does it make you feel that this is what's happening in Europe?
In Europe now, I suppose there's a genuine sense that we need to change the way that our societies function, in particular the necessity of thinking about the social and economic at the same time, which has been a weakness of European integration, a tendency to focus on the economic and then to leave social factors to be dealt with by so-called nation states or member states. And clearly that doesn't work. And you've got to think of them all at the same time, including the ecological crisis or collapse that we face. But I think there's an assumption now, certainly in Northern Europe, and it's sweeping across Europe, that this is easier done without the UK messing things up. And that's an absolute tragedy in itself, of course, that many people in the European Parliament, in the Commission, in the Council of Ministers and in Member States think we can address the challenges of Europe much more easily without the country that's held us back for so long. It was the UK that wanted to open up for uncontrolled freedom of movement. it was the UK that wanted to resist common immigration and asylum policies. It was the UK that wanted to open early for Central and Eastern European freedom of movement. And it was the UK that wanted to try and allow freedom of movement with limited restrictions on social questions, and indeed didn't apply the EU rules adequately in the social sector. Now, I'm not saying this is all against immigration, but it's the UK that has been the thorn in the side of so many of the problems that have spread since the 1990s across the EU. So many UK countries, France and Germany, Sweden and Denmark, think, OK, the challenges that we face are going to be much easier to do when we don't have the UK stood there making things harder to reach decisions.
So it's very interesting to get a European perspective on these issues, because, of course, very often we get the British side of affairs. And quite often, even in speaking with British people who live in the EU, they're focused very much on, well, they're reeling from what Britain is doing or what's happening in Britain, rather than necessarily being able to reflect on what's happening, you know, more close to where they are in respect to those questions about Brexit. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Michaela Benson, and produced by Emma Halton at Art of Podcast. The series is part of a UK and a Changing Europe funded research project, Brexit Brits Abroad, that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU 27. We're really keen to hear from you about the issues and concerns we address in the programme. So please do get in touch with any thoughts, queries and questions. You can find our contact details on our webpage, Brexit Brits Abroad, or get in touch via social media. We're on Twitter at BrexpatsEU, and we have a Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. Finally, in case you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so on both iTunes and Google Podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.